This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Within reach, Iran says negotiations with the nuclear accord partners in Vienna can bear fruit if the West shows goodwill. Relations between the US and Russia taking a turn for the worse as the two sides trade barbs over the situation in Ukraine. Plus, the UN chief calls into question the fairness of travel bans in place over the new COVID variant, saying they're unlikely to produce the desired effect. Thank you for joining us. We begin this hour in Vienna, where fresh talks are underway between Iran and the remaining parties to the country's nuclear deal. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says a good deal is within reach if the West shows goodwill. According to the top diplomat, the Iranian team is holding negotiations in a serious and logical manner and pursuing the removal of sanctions as the chief outcome of the talks. He says he's being constantly updated by the Iranian negotiators. The latest round of the talks has been ongoing for 3 days now, after a six-month pause. Earlier, we heard from a senior member of Iran's negotiating team that they're prepared to continue the talks for as long as necessary. He said that Iran will not sacrifice the legitimate rights and demands of its people by rushing into artificial deadlines. Joining us is Barry Grossman, international lawyer from Badi. Barry, it's good to see you. So Iran essentially saying the current talks can work out if the West shows goodwill. Do you think it will?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, what we can say is that Iran's position has been consistent indeed, since the JCPOA, since that was being negotiated. Iran's position is that the U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA without good reason and refused to make good on its commitments, but as an act of good faith has been willing to re-enter talks in order to restore what in fact had been decided by the JCPOA. As long as the agreement that's ultimately made is an all-encompassing agreement rather than something that appears to be an all-encompassing agreement, only to see that the Americans or the English or who knows who else take the position that there are separate issues which can still be held against Iran to justify the imposition of sanctions, things like Iran exercising its right to have a defensive conventional missile program, for example. So one would think if indeed the Americans are being straight up and reasonable, there really shouldn't be any obstacle, but that's a rather big assumption. And it's always important to bear in mind that it's not always the executive branch that ultimately makes policy and makes the decisions on these matters. There's a whole lot taking place within the security apparatus in consultation with American allies in the region and elsewhere, including Saudi Arabia and Israel. So we'll have to wait to see.
Right.
But I do feel myself that Iran's position is commendable. Even after all that's happened, that is, the Americans essentially creating a state of open warfare against Iran, albeit economic warfare and sort of proxy warfare in Iraq and Syria, Iran still has been willing to sit at the table and negotiate in good faith and return to the agreement which was violated by the Americans. And
right.
On any reasonable analysis, one would expect that the Americans would get with the program. After all, this is now a Democratic administration, as Obama's was a Democratic Party administration, and it's hard to understand why the U.S. Government at this stage would not want to go back to the deal that was made under the Obama administration.
Right. There is the issue of sanctions, Barry, as well, you know. Iranian funds frozen illegally, internationally, abroad. And on the other hand, we hear that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful in nature. And we don't hear that from Iran itself. We hear that from American and Israeli intelligence agencies. So is this really about the nuclear aspect, or is it more to do with destroying Iran's economy or attempts to destroy Iran's economy?
Well, look, I took the position from the beginning of the process that produced the JCPOA that the imperative of negotiating the JCPOA, as it was presented publicly by the United States and others, wasn't really at all concerned with concerns about Iran supposedly having a nuclear weapons program or basically expediting the position in order to be able to start one. After all, the 17 agencies comprising the U.S. security apparatus had said for many years in their individual classified briefings to Congress that Iran didn't have a nuclear weapons program and had no plans to start one. So it was always about something else. And as for sanctions, I think maybe a lot of people don't understand this because most people don't actually read the treaty, don't read the JCPOA. But one of the imperatives of the JCPOA that took effect immediately once it was implemented was that all pre-existing sanctions were taken away. They became ineffective. That is, they were canceled. So the sanctions that we are seeing in place now, targeting Iran economically, are new sanctions imposed unilaterally by the United States. There are no sanctions against Iran, championed by the international community, the United Nations, the Atomic Energy Commission, or any other international organization. The sanctions which are targeting Iran today and for the last few years are unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States in violation of the JCPOA, and which the United States has essentially using very strong-arm tactics, tried to compel other nations,
okay,
especially Atlantic nations, to enforce.
All right. Barry, thank you very much indeed for your time and your contribution. Barry Grossman, the international lawyer, joining us live out of Bali. Now, we're receiving breaking news out of Yemen about Saudi coalition warplanes bombing the capital, Sana'a. Just hours ago, jet fighters pounded the city several times, So far, no word on possible casualties. Some media outlets are reporting that the aerial bombardments targeted military sites in Sana'a and that civilians were asked to stay away from those targets. But in recent weeks, Saudi air raids and mortar shells have resulted in multiple civilian casualties. Just 2 days ago, the international airport in Sana'a was bombed. Hundreds of thousands have been killed and millions displaced since Saudi Arabia attacked Yemen to restore a friendly regime more than 6 years ago. Saudi Arabia, meanwhile, has reportedly used, quote, incentives and threats to shut down a UN investigation of human rights violations committed in Yemen. British media have quoted sources with close knowledge of the matter as saying that Riyadh has lobbied heavily against the Yemen probe. They say the Saudis even succeeded in their efforts when the UN Human Rights Council voted against extending an independent war crimes probe. Sources describe the Saudi lobbying move as a stealth campaign in which, they say, Riyadh influenced officials in order to guarantee the defeat of the measure. As part of the campaign, the kingdom is alleged to have threatened Indonesia, given incentives to Togo. Saudi Arabia, along with some regional allies, waged a war on Yemen in 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed since then. Political commentator Faraz Najm believes Saudi Arabia and its allies are using tactics such as bribing and blackmailing to cover up their war crimes in Yemen.
It's nothing new with the Saudis and their tactics and their strategies with the United Nations. You know, we look back even in 2016 when Ban Ki-moon was the United Nations Secretary General, and they actually blackmailed him because they were listed as you know, child abusers and child killers. So they're really paying people off. They're bribing people. They're blackmailing. And this is how they work with their relations. And they've been taught by the colonizers that put them in power. And that is the British and the Americans and, you know, obviously their allies now, the Zionists. So they're all working together and lobbying together. And it's the same tactics. So they're teaching each other and they're using it in every way just to cover their war crimes and to, evade any kind of accountability, any type of punishment. And there's this coalition of war criminal regimes that don't care about democracy, don't respect democracy, within their own, within their own nations. I mean, if anybody criticizes them, they massacre them, or they kill them, or they arrest them, or whatever. They don't give no respect for human rights organizations inside Saudi Arabia or the UAE at all.
The United States has once again accused Russia of planning for a potential military action against neighboring Ukraine.
We're deeply concerned by evidence that Russia has made plans for significant aggressive moves against Ukraine. The plans include efforts to destabilize Ukraine from within, as well as large-scale military operations.
Antony Blinken says Washington is deeply concerned by evidence showing that Russia is stepping up plans. He warns, however, that Russia will face, quote, a range of high-impact economic measures in case of an invasion of its western neighbor. The NATO Secretary General has also warned Moscow against attacking Ukraine, saying Russia will face a high price, as well as serious economic and political consequences. Meanwhile, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has expressed concern about the presence of NATO troops near Russian borders.
The threat on our western borders really grows, and we have talked about it repeatedly. Just look at how close to Russian borders came the military infrastructure of the North Atlantic Alliance. We take it more than seriously.
So Putin says he wants serious talks with Washington and its allies in order to obtain guarantees that NATO will not expand further east. He accuses the West of breaking its promises regarding its military presence near Russia. Moscow has also, time and again, denied accusations that it is planning to launch an attack on Ukraine. It says the presence of Russian troops near the Ukrainian borders is a defensive move, as Kiev has already deployed half of its army near Russia. The rise in tensions comes ahead of a planned meeting between the Russian foreign minister and his American counterpart in the Swedish capital on Thursday. William Jones is the editor of the Executive Intelligence Review magazine. He believes the confrontation between Russia and the West is likely, given that NATO has been squeezing Moscow for decades.
Well, I certainly hope they start to talk, and I just hope that the talk leads to something concrete, because the way it's going now, it seems to me that we're moving towards a confrontation of sorts. I don't think Russia intends to attack, but they do feel, rightly, that they are being squeezed by NATO. It's not just over the last few weeks, it's over the last few years, really over the last couple of decades, where NATO has expanded consistently and steadily towards the Russian border. And this was not what was thought in the beginning when the Warsaw Pact broke up and the NATO Pact did not break up. There were also definitely promises of sorts that were given that NATO would not expand. NATO was an alliance that was formed specifically to fight the Soviet Union. It was specifically geared against Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union.
The European Union is imposing fresh sanctions on 28 Belarusian individuals and firms over a migrant crisis along the border with Poland. The targets include 17 officials and 11 companies and official bodies. The United States is also planning to introduce similar measures against Belarus. Brussels has accused Minsk of mounting what it calls a hybrid attack against the EU by bringing the migrants to the bloc's doorsteps in retaliation for earlier sanctions. Minsk rejects the allegation, blaming the West for the crisis. Thousands of asylum seekers, mainly from West Asia, have been trying to cross into the EU via Poland while facing tough conditions. At least 11 have died since the crisis began in August. The US has detected its first case of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus in the state of California.
The individual was a traveler who returned from South Africa on November the 22nd and tested positive on November the 29th. The individual is self-quarantining, and all close contacts have been contacted, and all close contacts thus far have tested negative.
Fauci says the patient was fully vaccinated but did not have a booster shot. He also says the person in question is now experiencing mild symptoms, which are improving. According to the top U.S. infectious disease expert, Omicron might elude some vaccine protection. Meanwhile, the UN chief has slammed restrictions imposed to curb the spread of the new strain as what he calls travel apartheid. Antonio Guterres says the bans are unfair, punitive, and ineffective. The new variant has been found in 24 countries. The World Health Organization has designated it as a variant of concern. The European Commission has called for a common and coordinated approach by EU member states to contain the spread of COVID-19. Now, some of the bloc's 27 member states are taking steps which impact the EU's free travel area. Senior EU officials say that's a wrong approach. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
onto our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
According to a newly released account from the CIA, Donald Trump's fact-free approach to the presidency created unprecedented challenges for intelligence officials responsible for briefing him. We're prepared for you an article written by Richard Luscombe under the heading, CIA Report Says Trump's Fact-Free Approach Caused Briefing Challenges. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Thank you. According to a newly released account from the CIA, former U.S. President Donald Trump's fact-free approach to the presidency created unprecedented challenges for intelligence officials responsible for briefing him. The report states that the 45th president's chaotic and freewheeling style and his disinclination to read anything put in front of him resulted in the Presidential Daily Briefing, or PDB, a crucial security update including information about potential threats to the United States, being delivered more regularly to Vice President Mike Pence instead. By the middle of Donald Trump's term in office, his briefings were reduced to two weekly sessions of 45 minutes each. Briefings were discontinued altogether after a deadly insurrection on 6th of January, which was sparked by Donald Trump urging his supporters to march on the U.S. Capitol in a failed attempt to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden. The analysis comes in a 40-page unclassified update to the CIA's Getting to Know the President, a publication that chronicles efforts to brief presidents-elect through transition periods and into office for every administration since 1952. The new chapter, posted to the CIA website, concludes, "For the intelligence community, the Trump transition was far and away the most difficult in its historical experience with briefing new presidents." The CIA website added, "Trump was like Richard Nixon, suspicious and insecure about the intelligence process, but unlike Nixon in the way he reacted. Rather than shut the intelligence community out, Donald Trump engaged with it but attacked it publicly." Richard Nixon, who resigned in 1974 after the Watergate scandal, refused to accept any intelligence from the CIA and received briefings instead from trusted insiders, such as his national security advisor and later his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. Donald Trump regularly assailed intelligence officials and famously chose to believe the Russian President Vladimir Putin over agencies, including the CIA, which concluded that Russia had meddled in the 2016 presidential election. The CIA report's author, retired career intelligence officer John L. Helgeson, said briefers achieved only limited success in their mission to deliver timely and relevant intelligence to Donald Trump and to establish a working relationship with him. Mike Pence, by contrast, was a six-day-a-week reader who made efforts to try to keep Donald Trump focused. The vice president urged briefers to lean forward on maps in graphics-heavy presentations much shorter than those presented to Donald Trump's predecessors, and would sometimes ask leading questions during joint sessions with Trump so the president would hear his concerns. Retired career intelligence officer John Helgeson suggests Mike Pence's efforts were largely unsuccessful. According to the CIA report, James Clapper, a former director of the National Intelligence, said Donald Trump was prone to fly off on tangents and said, "There might be only 8 or 9 minutes of real intelligence in an hour's discussion." Additionally, James Clapper said, while the intelligence community worked with evidence, Donald Trump was fact-free. Evidence doesn't cut it with him. Helgeson writes, "Trump preferred that the briefer take the lead and summarize the key points and important items from the day since they had last had a session." The presidential daily briefing was published every day, but because Donald Trump received the briefing only 2 or 3 times a week, he relied on the briefer to orally summarize the significance of the most important issues. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the subject to which Donald Trump paid most attention were China and developments involving Russia and Ukraine. The first of the former president's two impeachments was for pressing Ukraine to investigate his political rival Joe Biden, then his likely 2020 election opponent. He was also investigated for allegedly colluding with Russia. The CIA report states a few subjects and areas of the world were notable by their relative absence, adding, regarding Europe, only NATO budget issues, Turkey, and approaching elections in France and Germany stimulated much discussion. Latin America, Africa, and Southeast Asia received almost no attention. Overall, Helgeson believes the briefing process barely survived Donald Trump's presidency. Helgeson noted, he publicly criticized the outgoing directors of National Intelligence and the CIA and disparaged the substantive work and integrity of the intelligence agencies. From the outset, it was clear that the intelligence community was in for a difficult time. The system worked, but it struggled.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The United States is appealing a British judge's decision not to extradite Julian Assange, the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. In January, Judge Baretzer found that U.S. prison conditions would be too oppressive and that Assange would be likely to take his own life. In response, the United States has taken to the High Court to contest her findings about Assange's health. In addition, the United States has offered up diplomatic assurances, saying that it won't put Assange in oppressive prison conditions, which doctors have said would lead to suicide. So what exactly are these diplomatic assurances that the United States has offered? And can they actually be trusted? How come Assange's health is the center of the discussion when scores of legal experts, academics, journalists, and historians have all warned that this indictment currently poses the biggest threat to press freedoms? To answer these questions, I attended the court proceedings remotely as they unfolded in London's High Court. And this is what I saw. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The High Court appeal took place on October 27 and 28 of 2021, lasting just 2 days. The United States is appealing Judge Bretz's decision not to extradite Julian Assange on five grounds. These five grounds can be summed up in two topics. Number one, Assange's health, and number two, the diplomatic assurances. We'll deal first with Assange's health. As we've mentioned before, Judge Baretzer blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S., namely on health grounds. So what has the United States responded? Well, the U.S. lawyers argue that she erred in her judgment, that she didn't apply the test correctly, that Assange doesn't meet the criteria for his extradition to be oppressive. They accuse him of essentially being a malingerer, someone who's pretending to be sick. Professor Michael Koppelman is the lead medical expert for the defense. Koppelman's testimony is very important because the judge relied heavily on it to block the extradition. She said that she preferred his testimony because his notes were more detailed than the other doctors. Koppelman also spent the most time with Assange. So because Koppelman's testimony is so crucial for the defense, the United States lawyers have tried desperately to discredit both the report and Koppelman. In his first psychiatric report, Koppelman did not disclose the relationship between Julian Assange and Stella Morris, or that they had had two children in the Ecuadorian embassy. Although this point has nothing to do with medicine or psychiatry, the United States is exploiting it to accuse Koppelman of misleading the court. They say that his medical evidence should be given little or no weight. Now, Assange's lawyers replied that Koppelman did not conceal anything from the court. He only kept the relationship secret because he was concerned for the privacy and safety of Miss Morris and her children. This happened right around the time when we were finding out about Assange being spied on in the Ecuadorian embassy, among other things. In her ruling, Judge Bretzer did say that she found this behavior from Koppelman misleading and inappropriate, but an understandable human response to Miss Morris' predicament. The lead prosecutor for the United States, James Lewis, accuses Assange of being a malingerer trying to avoid extradition. In the High Court, Lewis said that, quote, if he's clever enough, he can get around extradition. It then becomes a trump card, which cannot be dealt with by the requesting state, no matter if the prevention matters are 100 times better than in England. The prosecution argued that Assange did not meet the criteria under the Turner test, meaning he must be unable to resist the impulse to commit suicide. Only that could block extradition. Now, Assange's lawyers respond that Professor Koppelman did find this to be the case. Koppelman said that Assange cannot resist the impulse to commit suicide. If he's extradited, he will take his own life. Assange's lawyers also pointed out that there are people who make plans to take their own lives. That's not impulsive, but it's still driven by their mental disorder. And so it's unreasonable, it doesn't make sense, to say that Assange is not suicidal just because he's not impulsively suicidal. Now, the entire appeal hearing at the High Court is, of course, too large to condense into one episode, but nevertheless, it consisted of various accusations from the prosecution that the defense's medical experts were lacking in expertise or integrity. For example, that Koppelman had misled the court, that Dr. Dealey was wrong in his autism diagnosis, and so forth. Now, the other main topic discussed in the High Court was that of diplomatic assurances. The United States has said that if Assange is extradited, it will not place him in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are some of the worst prison conditions imaginable. The U.S. also says that Assange won't be sent to AVX Florence, one of the worst prisons in the country. Robert Hood, the former warden at AVX Florence, described it as worse than death. The U.S. also claims that Assange could serve a potential sentence in his home country of Australia. In the High Court, I actually saw Lewis say that Assange can't be that suicidal because he can look forward to going to jail in Australia, as if going to jail in one's home country is something that every journalist dreams of. Now, the prosecution claimed that they weren't given a fair chance to offer these assurances before, and had they, the judge would have decided differently. Well, Assange's lawyers point out that this isn't true. They say the United States had many opportunities to offer assurances that Assange won't be placed under SAMs. Instead, the prosecution not only said that SAMs are possible, but that they're okay. They said that Assange can play crochet and write poetry and self-recreate, which essentially means going into an adjacent empty room to spend time by himself. Now, Maureen Baird used to be the warden of a notorious jail in New York, Metropolitan Correctional Center, MCC. She testified at Assange's hearing and described what prison conditions are like in pretrial SAMs. She said that inmates were in solitary confinement, technically for 24 hours a day, There was absolutely no communication by any means with other inmates, and the only form of human interaction they had was when the guards came to inspect their cells or give them food through the slot in the door. Last year, when I was in court at the Old Bailey, I heard anonymous testimony from former employees of UC Global. UC Global is the Spanish firm in charge of security at the Ecuadorian embassy where Assange had been given political asylum. Now, the employees described how the United States got them to spy on Assange by installing cameras and secret microphones, and there were even discussions about physically hurting or kidnapping the WikiLeaks founder. And last week, for the first time, we saw the Yahoo News story brought up in court. Published in September, it has 30 U.S. officials admitting that the CIA was discussing plans to potentially assassinate Assange or kidnap him in London. This corroborated what we already knew from UC Global. Assange's lawyers pointed out that even former CIA Director Mike Pompeo confirmed this to be true. So if the decision to place Assange under SAMS is up to the Attorney General with kind input from the CIA, of course they're going to put him in SAMS. This is the same agency that was discussing maybe killing Assange. It's the same agency whose files he published in 2017 in the Vault 7 leaks. There is no doubt that they will put him in SAMS. Now, Assange's lawyers explained that even if Assange isn't placed in SAMS, which is certain he will be, he can still be put in other oppressive conditions. Mark Summers, Assange's lawyer, said, "You can proceed entirely confident that in the event of surrender to the USA, Julian Assange will enter into administrative segregation, ADSEG, at Alexandria for years." He added that ADSEG is isolation. There is no assurance from the US not to place Assange under ADSEG. All the evidence, including Kronberg's, is that ADSEG is in prospect for Mr. Assange. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even if ADX Colorado is off the table, Assange would be sent to a communications management unit, or CMU. It's a prison within a prison, an experiment in social isolation. Correspondence is limited to 1 6-page letter a week to one recipient. And in regards to being sent to Australia, Assange's lawyer argued that, first of all, Australia hasn't even accepted or said yes. And even if it did say yes, who says that future politicians would agree? We have no idea who will be in power in 10 years when this process is actually finished. This is a process that could take a very long time, and Assange would most certainly be in isolation for the entire duration. That isolation would lead him to take his own life, as doctors confirmed to the court. Now, the United States lawyers said that these assurances are solemn undertakings given out at the highest order. These are not dished out like Smarties. Lewis added that the United States has never broken a diplomatic assurance ever. Now, Assange's lawyers don't believe that to be true. They say these assurances can't be trusted because they are worded in a way that binds the prosecutors but not the Department of Justice. So even if Assange is extradited and placed in SAMS and he complains, the Department of Justice can just say, "We never promised you that." Assange's lawyers gave examples of other people who were given false assurances by the U.S. They were extradited, thinking they'd be placed in a medical unit or hospitalized, and then sent instead to ADX. The United States even has a disclaimer in the assurance where it practically admits that Assange will be placed under SAMS. It says very clearly, Mr. Assange will not be subject to SAMS or imprisonment in ADX unless he does something that would warrant them, like threatening national security. This means they certainly will place him under SAMS because the whole case is built on the false premise that Assange and WikiLeaks endangered national security. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even in the event of acquittal in the United States, what Gordon Kronberg could do is summon him before a grand jury, incarcerate him for civil contempt, and place him in a special housing unit. So even if Assange is acquitted, he could still go back to jail. And it's not just a possibility, it's actually a likelihood, because Kronberg did precisely this to Chelsea Manning when she refused to testify against Julian Assange. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
Now joining me is Kevin Gostola, an American journalist whose work focuses on whistleblower and national security cases. Besides the Assange court hearings, he's also covered the cases of Chelsea Manning, John Kiriakou, Daniel Hale, and others. Kevin is also the managing director of Shadowproof, as well as producer and co-host of the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. So Kevin, given the United States history, what they've done to other prisoners who were also given so-called assurances, not diplomatic ones, but nevertheless, they were misled, weren't they? I mean, if we look at what they did to Daniel Hale just a few months ago, or Chelsea Manning, which you both covered, do you lend these diplomatic assurances any credence above others?
All four of these assurances have significant loopholes. I'll start with the more generic thing that we should really look at, which is the UK government is supposedly the government that would represent Julian Assange's interests if he did not think the US government upheld the assurances that are given by the US government. So in other words, what we see in the United States' argument to the High Court of Justice that we should trust the US government's assurances is that he would have the ability to file some kind of a challenge if he didn't believe that they were being upheld. And he would first go to the UK government, and they would tell the US government that Julian Assange says he isn't getting the medical care he needs, or he believes it's wrong that he's been put in special administrative measures, or that he's in these restrictive solitary conditions in Alexandria Detention Center while waiting to be put on trial. And that is ridiculous because the UK government, I can't imagine wanting to be any sort of ally of Julian Assange given what they've done. Well, first off, this isn't really even about the case, but we know from Italian journalist Stefania Merizzi that the UK government has actively fought Freedom of Information Act requests for basic details about what these services in the country, like the Crown Prosecution Service, I think she might have even asked for records from the police department, what they were doing in order to target people who are associates of WikiLeaks, like Kristen Harrison, who's now the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Joseph Farrell, Sarah Harrison, who, by the way, is an unindicted co-conspirator in the latest indictment in this case, something that is concerning. And so she's asked for these records, and they won't give them to her. And then also... We know that there are records that have been destroyed historically related to the Assange extradition, going back to the Swedish case. But in the last decade, we know that there are records that no longer exist because the government actually destroyed those records. And this is the government we're supposed to believe will advocate for Assange to the U.S. government, that he should not be mistreated and that his human rights should be upheld. It's laughable.
You know, we heard things in court about how Assange could communicate with prisoners above and below through the plumbing. You know, Kronberg insists that ADSEG is not isolation. I mean, what do you think of not just ADSEG, but also the other kinds of hellholes they could put Assange in, right? Because his lawyers pointed out there's a possibility of being sent to a CMU or an SHU. I mean, are these, you know, prisons that different from ADX? You know, having covered Chelsea Manning and Daniel Hale's trials, you know all too well that they have a way of putting these people through enormous suffering, don't they?
Yeah. So let's take Chelsea Manning. She went through untold amounts of suffering for a year in a jail, refusing to cooperate with this grand jury. And toward the end, she attempted suicide yet again. Another time she had attempted suicide when she was at Fort Leavenworth serving her sentence, her military prison sentence. So again, this put her in a position where she was near a psychotic break, and she attempted suicide, and she did that because of the conditions of her her jailing, her detention, while she was resisting a grand jury subpoena. She didn't know when she was going to be released. She ended up being released a few days after attempting suicide. This happened to her. If it happened to her, it could happen to Julian Assange while he's awaiting trial. This is the same jail that Daniel Hale was sent to while awaiting sentencing. They put him in there because they wanted to make everyone believe that his post-traumatic stress that he has from the moral injury of being involved in the drone program was something that was driving him crazy, and he was going to do self-harm to himself. His therapist actually ratted him out to pretrial services, and he ended up being thrown in jail and not able to prepare himself for going to prison. You know, do things like find a home for his cat, take care of any bills that he had, outstanding payments, put all of his things in order so that he could then go to prison. Something that a lot of people get to do when they know that they're going to be going off to prison. And they deprived him of his ability to do that. He was just picked up, taken to a jail, and he hasn't been free since. And now he's in a CMU, a communications management unit, and there he is in conditions that, in terms of social visits, it's actually worse than special administrative measures. It's been described as worse by the Center for Constitutional Rights because you do not have contact visits with any individuals who come to see you. So immediate family come, Stella, her children, his children come, Gabriel and Max, and he's on the other side of a partition. There's glass. He speaks, you know, I think he grabs the telephone, think of like the movies where they talk through the glass. He never gets to touch. He never gets to hug. He doesn't get to kiss his kids. They don't get to sit on his lap. He doesn't get to share any moments with them while he is in this facility if he gets sentenced to a CMU.
So besides an SHU or a CMU, I mean, what else could they do? Because ADCEG is pretty much guaranteed. If you ask me, SAMs are also pretty much guaranteed. Do you also feel that way, that these things are you know, practically set in stone for Assange?
Well, the other thing we should be concerned about, and Kronberg lays it out very clearly, is that Assange could be put in protective custody because he's a high-profile prisoner. And what that means is they get to do all sorts of things that they did to Chelsea Manning when she was first detained and was awaiting trial. You remember the international scandal that was sparked by her treatment at the Quantico Marine Brig, which has since been shut down. It actually does not exist. There are not people detained there anymore. And so, and in that facility, I remember they took her clothing away, they took her underwear away, they took, you know, they made her wear the suicide smock, which I saw displayed during the court martial. I saw her put it on and demonstrate what it was like. It's this like itchy, uncomfortable thing that like nobody would be comfortable sleeping in, and especially in a prison. And they did this to her by twisting her words against her and reading into it the worst intentions. It was sarcasm, or she was talking about, you know, like, if you're going to do this to me, I could take the elastic in my waistband and I could do this with it. And then just, I guess, to be a smart aleck, the military person who was overseeing her treatment decided, well, we need to take this seriously and take all of the clothing away. And when they called roll in the morning, she came out of her cell and she's completely naked. Everyone else has on what they're wearing in the prison. And everyone, you know, the people who are doing security for that prisoner, sort of like, why does this inmate not have any clothing on? She was treated like that as part of protective custody, the idea that they had to make sure no matter what, she survived and made it to her trial. Don't think they won't do the same thing to Julian Assange. They will say that they are putting him in restrictive conditions to protect his own safety in order to prevent him from doing anything to himself. They will take his mental health. They will use all of the worst claims that the defense has made to try and save him, and they will turn them against Julian Assange so that he is even more miserable, if you can believe it. And you may not think, how could you be more miserable? They will find a lower low that they can take this while he is in confinement.
So, Kevin, a lot of people ask you and me when we're covering this case, when we'll get a decision from the judges, where we think this is going. When you or I were talking last time, you pulled out this very big chart with all the possibilities of where Assange's judicial process could go. Could you maybe walk us through all these various outcomes?
Yes, so if you look down at the left part of the screen toward the middle, you'll see that it says the U.S. appeals to the High Court. That's where we are We're also, I think there's another box that has U.S. appeals to the High Court, but that's not the same route. Anyways, if you go down to the bottom here, now where you're circling, there are three actions that can happen. The court can dismiss it. Well, then what's going to happen is the U.S. will appeal, and it'll go before the Supreme Court. If it accepts these assurances, these diplomatic assurances that we do not find to be of any value, then it'll potentially go back down to the district court level. And so you basically go back to go. And you have a hearing before, I hope it would be a different judge and not Vanessa Beretzer, but I suppose things have been kind of bizarre already, so maybe she gets to have another crack at it. And but again, I would think that it would be a different judge. It should be. And they would have a hearing on these assurances and discuss why the legal team for Assange would have a hearing much like the extradition hearing in September 2020. And they would say, look, you know, we're sorry we have to do this. We don't like being here. The U.S. should have put these forward a long time ago, but now they have, and we're here to put evidence and bring forward witnesses and say that we do not believe that these assurances should be taken seriously, and then the judge would review them and decide, based on those assurances, whether to reject the extradition request or not. And then the appeals continue, and we go back to the High Court for another hearing, and then we go back to the UK Supreme Court for another hearing. And then that's the last stage.
Kevin Gostola, thank you so much for your time and your brilliant reporting. Keep up the good work. It's a pleasure speaking with you. No date has been set by the judges on when they will hand down a decision, but they did say they were given a lot to think about. And I agree, there is a lot to think about. Namely, why is this entire hearing focusing on Assange's health? You know, we can now see very clearly why January's decision was a positive but an inadequate one. While the judge blocked the extradition, which is good, she only did it on health grounds. Meanwhile, the political charges, she agreed with them all. So right now, the whole discussion has shifted to Assange's health. You know, WikiLeaks published evidence of war crimes carried out by U.S. forces, intelligence agencies, and their allies. But instead of holding those politicians and soldiers accountable, the British justice system, at the behest of the United States, is putting Julian Assange on trial. And not just that, but his mental health on trial as well, reinforcing negative stigmas and stereotypes about mental illness. And when we talk about assurances, it's very important to point out the U.S. has broken promises it made to other prisoners many times before. They purposely word these things in a way that binds the prosecutors, but not the Department of Justice, which means they're useless because the Department of Justice is the only one who has the power to grant these assurances in the first place. Let's be clear on something. Even if Assange were in perfect health, he should not be extradited because it is the wrong thing to do. Even if the United States says it will place him in a five-star hotel, it's still not okay to extradite him for doing his job. What is happening here is unprecedented. This is a vendetta. It's a witch hunt against Assange because his journalism threatens the most powerful armies and governments on Earth. A journalist should not have to prove that they are sick and suicidal beyond hope just to avoid extradition to a foreign country they have no connection to. If Julian Assange is suicidal in the first place, it is because they have made him this way by persecuting him. He has been persecuted by the same government that now claims it will treat him well. I'm sorry, but if you think the United States is not going to lock up Julian Assange in some dark hellhole the moment he sets foot on U.S. soil, then you're really kidding yourself. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
No matter what deceptive words UN officials and politicians of the West use to try to lull Palestinians and their sympathizers into sleep, November 29th remains an indelible blot on the world body. Actually, it is the day that has come to highlight the shortcomings of the UN and its member states as the Zionist occupiers grow more entrenched with each passing year, while trampling the basic rights of the Palestinian people under their feet. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kahan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Day of Deceit. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On November 29th, the United Nations observed the 44th anniversary of its so-called International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people with a speech by Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who actually poured salt on the gaping wounds of an oppressed nation. Without presenting any practical solution to the chronic crisis and ignoring the injustice done by the world body in 1947, in partitioning a predominantly Muslim land to illegally create a state for the unauthorized Jewish migrants from Europe, he vaguely said the international community should reaffirm its commitment to the people of Palestine in building their future. Then, in the next part of his speech, he directly hit the poor Palestinians where it hurts most by saying,